Lord Kelvin's Machine by James Blaylock. Prologue, South America. Langdon St. Ives, scientist and explorer, clutched a heavy alpaca blanket about his shoulders and stared out across countless miles of rocky plateau and jagged volcanic peaks. The tight weave of ivory wool clipped off a dry, chill wind that blew across the 50 miles of Antarctic-spawned Peruvian coastal current up from the Bay of Guayaquil and across the Pacific slope of the Peruvian Andes. A wide and sluggish river, gray-green beneath the lowering sky, crept across broad grasslands behind and below him. Moored like an alien vessel amid the bunched grasses and tola bush was a tiny zeppelin, silver in the afternoon sun, and flying the Union Jack from a jury-rigged mast. At St. Ives' feet, the scree-strewn rim of a volcanic cone, Mount Acapaxi, fell 2,000 feet toward steamy open fissures, the entire crater glowing like the bowl of an enormous pipe. St. Ives waved ponderously to his companion, Hasbro, his gentleman's gentleman, actually, who crouched some hundreds yards down the slope on the interior of the cone, working the compression mechanism of a Rawls-Hibbing mechanical bladder. Coils of India rubber hose snaked away, disappearing into the cracks in the ignatius skin of the mountainside. A cloud of fierce sulfur-laced steam whirled suddenly up and out of the crater in a wild, sighing rush, and the red glow of the twisted fissures winked out abruptly, replaced by misty darkness. St. Ives nodded, satisfied, and consulted a pocket watch. His left shoulder, recently grazed by a bullet, throbbed tiredly. It was late afternoon. Long shadows cast by scattered distant peaks obscured the hillside roundabout. On the heels of the shadows would come darkness. The figure below ceased his furious manipulations of the contrivance and signaled to St. Ives, whereupon the scientist turned and repeated the signal, a broad windmill gesture visible to several thousand Indians massed on the plain below. "Sharp's the word, Jackie," muttered St. Ives under his breath, and straight away, thin and sailing on the knife-edge wind, came a half-dozen faint syllables, first in English, then repeated in Quechua, then giving way to the resonant cadence of almost 5,000 people marching in step. He could feel the rhythmic reverberations beneath his feet as he turned, bent over, and mouthing a quick and silent prayer, depressed the plunger of the tubular detonator. He threw himself flat and pressed an ear to the cold ground. The rumble of marching feet rolled through the hillsides like the sound of an approaching express or the rushing passage of a subterranean river. Then, abruptly, a deep and vast explosion, muffled by the crust of the earth itself, heaved the ground in a tumultuous wave, and appeared to St. Ives from his area atop the volcano as if the grassland below were a giant carpet and that the gods were shaking the dust from it. The marching horde pitched higgly-piggly into one another and collapsed all of a heap. The stars in the eastern sky seemed to dance briefly as if the earth had been jiggled from her course. Then slowly, the ground ceased to shake. St. Ives smiled for the first time in nearly a week. His man Hasbro strode up the hillside towards him, carrying the Rawls-Hibbing's apparatus, and together they watched the sky deepen from blue to purple, cut by the pale radiance of the Milky Way. On the horizon glowed a misty semicircle of radiance like a lantern hooded with muslin, the first faint glimmer of an ascending comet. Chapter 1. Dover. The tumbled rocks of Castle Jetty loomed black and wet in the fog. Below, where the gray tide of the North Sea fell inch by inch away, green tufts of waterweed alternately danced and collapsed across barnacled stone, and brown penny crabs scuttled through dark crevices as if their sideways scramble would render them invisible to the men who stood above. Langdon St. Ives, wrapped in a greatcoat and shod in hip boots, cocked a telescope spyglass to his eye and squinted north toward the eastern docks. The mist swirled and flew, now covering the sea and sky in an opaque gray-green curtain, now tearing itself into transparent lace. There, some 150 meters distant, the steamer HMS Ramsgate heaved on the groundswell, its handful of paying passengers having hours since wended their way shoreward toward one of the inns along Castle Hill Road. All the passengers, that is, but one. St. Ives felt as if he'd stood atop the rocks for a lifetime, watching nothing at all but an empty ship. He lowered the glass and gazed down into the sea. It took an act of will to believe that beyond the strait lay Belgium, and that behind him, a bow shot distant, lay the city of Dover. He was overcome suddenly with the uncanny certainty that the jetty was moving, and that he stood on the bow of a sailing vessel plying the waters of a phantom sea. The rushing tide below him bent and swirled around the edges of the swirling rocks, and for a perilous second he felt himself pitch forward, nearly flinging the glass away and tumbling head first from his perch. A firm hand grasped his shoulder, and the vertigo passed. He caught himself, straightened, and wiped beaded moisture from his forehead with the sleeve of his coat. "Thank you." "Certainly, sir. Steady on, sir." "I've reached the limits of my patience, Hasbro," said St. Ives to the man beside him. "I'm convinced we're watching an empty ship. Our man has given us the ship, and I'd sooner have a look at the inside of a glass of ale than another look at that damn steamer." "Patience is his own reward, sir," replied St. Ives' manservant. St. Ives gave him a look. "My patience must be thinner than yours." He pulled the pouch from the pocket of his greatcoat, extracting a bent bulldog pipe and a quantity of tobacco. "Do you suppose Kraken has given up?" He pressed the curly black tobacco into the pipe bowl with his thumb and struck a match, the flame hissing and sputtering in the evening air. "Not Kraken, sir, if I'm any judge. If our man went ashore along the docks, then Kraken followed him. A disguise wouldn't answer, not with that hump. And it's an even bet that he wouldn't be away to London, not this late in the evening. For my money, he's in a public house, and Kraken's in the street outside. If he made his way away to the north, then Jack's got him, and the outcome is the same. The best—" "Hark!" Silence fell, interrupted only by the sighing of wavelets splashing against the stones of the jetty and by the hushed clatter of distant activity along the docks. The two men stood barely breathing, smoke from St. Ives' pipe rising invisibly into the fog. "There," whispered St. Ives, holding up his left hand. Softly, too rhythmically to be mistaken for the natural cadence of the ocean, came the muted dipping of oars and the creak of shafts in oarlocks. St. Ives crouched, then stepped gingerly across to an adjacent rock and clambered down into a small crab-infested grotto. He could just discern, through a sort of triangular window, the thin gray line where the sky met the sea, and there, pulling into view, was a long rowboat in which sat two men, one plying the oars, the other crouched on a thwart, wrapped in a dark blanket, and with a frazzle of black hair dropping in moist curls around his shoulders. "It's him," whispered Hasbro into St. Ives' ear. "That it is, and up to no good at all. He's bound for Hargreaves, or I'm a fool. We were right about this one. That eruption in Natvik was no eruption at all. It was a detonation. And now the task is unspeakably complicated. I'm half inclined to let the monster have a go at it, Hasbro. I'm weary of this world of late." St. Ives paused tiredly, the rowboat having disappeared into the fog, the night having drifted into silence. "There's the matter of the ale glass," said Hasbro wisely, grasping St. Ives by the elbow, "and a kidney pie, unless I'm amiss, is required. We'll fetch in Bill Kraken and Jack on the way. We have time enough for a stroll round to Hargreaves after supper." St. Ives squinted at Hasbro as if suddenly bucked by the idea of a pie and a glass of ale. "Of course we do," he said. "I might send you lads out alone tonight, though. I need about 10 hours of the best to bring me around. Sleep, that's the tune the piper's playing. In the morning I'll wrestle these demons." "There's the ticket, sir," said the stalwart Hasbro, and through the gathering gloom the two men picked their way from rock to rock to the warm lights of Dover. "I can't imagine I've ever been this hungry before," said St. Ives, spearing up a pair of rashers from a passing platter. "Any more eggs?" "Heaps," said Bill Kraken through a mouthful of cold toast, and reached for another platter at his elbow. "Full of the right sorts of humor, sir, is eggs. It's the unctuous secretions of the yolks that fetches the home steak, if you follow me. Loaded up with all manner of fluids." Jack Allesby paused, a fork full of egg halfway to his mouth. He gave Kraken a look and cleared his throat. "Sorry, lad. There's no stopping me when I'm swept off by the scientific. I forgot that you ain't partial to talk of fluids over breakfast. Not that it matters a bit about fluids or any of the rest of it. What with the comets mailing in to smash us to flinders—" "Harumph!" coughed St. Ives, seeming to choke, his fit drowning the last few words of Kraken's observation. "Lower your voice, man!" "Sorry, Professor. I don't think sometimes. You know me, this coffee tastes like rat poison, don't it? And not high-tone rat poison either, but something mixed up by your man with the bump." I haven't tried it, said St. Ives, raising his cup. He peered into the depths of the dark stuff and was reminded instantly of the murky water in the night-shrouded tide pool he'd slipped into on his way back from the tip of the jetty the night before. He didn't need to taste the brew. The smell of it was enough. Any of the tablets? He asked Hasbro. I brought several of each, sir. It doesn't pay to go abroad without them. One would think that the art of brewing coffee would have traveled the few miles from Normandy coast to the British Isles, sir, but we all know it hasn't. He reached into the pocket of his coat and pulled out a little vial of jelly bean-like pills. Jamaican blue, sir. If you would, said St. Ives. Hasbro dropped one into the upheld cup, and in an instant the room was filled with the astonishing heavy aroma of real coffee, the odd chemical spell of the palate facsimile in the rest of the cups retreating before it. By God, whispered Kraken, what else have you got there? A tolerable wiener melange, sir, and a mocha java that I can vouch for. There's an espresso, too, but it's untried as yet. Then I'm your man, cried the enthusiastic Kraken, and he held out his hand for the little pill. There's money in these, he said, plopping them into his full cup, and watching the results as if mystified. Millions of pounds. Art for art's sake, laughed St. Ives, dipping the end of a white kerchief into his cup, and studying the stained corner of it in the thin sunlight shining through the casement. He nodded, satisfied, then tasted the coffee, nodding again. He bent over his plate and addressed Bill Kraken, although his words clearly were intended for the assembled company. We mustn't, Bill, give in to fears about this heavenly visitation to lapse into metaphysical language. I woke up fresh this morning, a new man, and the solution, I discovered, was in front of my face. I'd been given it by the very villain we pursue. The only real enemy now is time, gentlemen, time and the excesses of our own fears. St. Ives paused to have another go at the coffee, then squinted past his cup and resumed his speech. The single greatest catastrophe now would be for the news to leak to the general public. The man in the street would dissolve into chaos if he knew what confronted him. Let us take a lesson in reverse from the otherwise admirable tale of Mr. H.G. Wells. His science was, I fear, awash with error, but that was no real fault of his. He was a literary man first, and a scientist afterward, but he was fearfully wide of the mark in underestimating the common man's susceptibility to panic. St. Ives stroked his chin, staring at the debris on his plate. I'm certain that science will save us this time, gentlemen, if it doesn't kill us first. The thing will be close, though, and if the public gets wind, great damage will come of it. He smiled into the befuddled faces of his three companions. Kraken wiped a dribble of egg from the edge of his mouth. Jack pursed his lips. I need to know about Hargreaves, continued St. Ives, and you'll want to know what I'm blathering about. But this isn't the place. Let's adjourn to the street, shall we? And with that, the men arose, Kraken tossing off the last of his coffee. Then, seeing that Jack was leaving half a cup, he tossed Jack's off too and mumbled something about waste and starvation as he followed the rest to the door. Dr. Ignacio Narbondo grinned over his tea. He watched the back of Hargreaves' head as it nodded above the great sheet of paper covered over with lines, numbers, and notations. Why oxygen allowed itself to flow in and out of the man's lungs, Narbondo couldn't say at all. The man seemed to be animated by hatred, an indiscriminate loathing of the most innocent things. He gladly built bombs for idiotic anarchist deviltry, not out of any particular regard for causes, but simply to create mayhem, to blow things to bits. If he could have built a device sufficiently large to obliterate the Dover Cliffs and the sun rising beyond them, he'd do it without hesitation. He loathed tea. He loathed eggs. He loathed brandy. He loathed the very art of constructing his infernal devices. Narbondo looked round him at the barren room, the lumpy pallet on the ground where Hargreaves allowed himself a few hours' miserable sleep, as often as not to lurch awake at night, a shriek half-uttered in his throat, as if he'd peered into a mirror and seen the face of a beetle staring back. Narbondo whistled merrily all of a sudden, watching Hargreaves stiffen, loathing the melody that had broken the discordant mumblings of his brain. Hargreaves turned, his bearded face set in a rictus of twisted rage, his dark, shrunken eyes blank as eclipsed moons. He breathed heavily. Narbondo waited with raised eyebrows, as if surprised at the man's reaction. "Damn a man that whistles," said Hargreaves, running the back of his hand across his mouth. He looked at his hand, expecting to find Lord knows what, and turned slowly back to his benchtop. Ignacio Narbondo smiled and poured himself another cup of tea. All in all, it was a glorious day. Hargreaves had agreed to help him destroy the Earth without so much as a second thought. He'd agreed with a certain amount of relish, in fact, had expended a moment's effort to twist his face into a contorted smile. Why he didn't just slit his throat and be done with life for good and all was one of the first great mysteries of the 20th century. He wouldn't have been half so agreeable if he knew that Narbondo had no intention of destroying anything, that his motivation was greed and revenge. His threat to cast the Earth forcibly into the path of the approaching comet wouldn't be taken lightly. There were those in the Royal Academy who knew he could do it, who supposed, no doubt, that he might quite likely do it. They were as foolish as Hargreaves, and every bit as useful. The surprising internal eruption of Mount Jarstead would throw the fear into them. They'd be quaking over their rashers at that very moment, the lot of them, wondering and gasping. Beards would be wagging, dark suspicions would be mouthed. Where was the doctor? Had he been seen in London? Not for months. He'd threatened this, hadn't he? An eruption above the Arctic Circle, just to demonstrate the seriousness of his intent? The comet would pass close enough to the Earth to provide a spectacular display for the masses. Foolish creatures. The iron core of the thing might easily be pulled so solidly by the Earth's magnetic field that the comet would hurtle groundward, slamming the poor old Earth into powder and all the gaping multitudes with it. What if, Narbondo had suggested, what if a man were to give the Earth a bit of a push to propel it even closer to the approaching star and so turn a long shot into a dead cert, as a blade of the turf might put it? Well, Dr. Ignacio Narbondo was that man. Could he do it? Narbondo grinned. His demands of 2 weeks past had been met with a sneer, but Mount Hajarstead would wipe the sneers from their faces. They'd wax grave. Their grins would set like plaster of Paris. What had the poet said about that sort of thing? Gravity was a mysterious carriage of the body to cover the defects of the mind. That was it. Gravity would answer for a day or two. But when it faded into futility, they'd pay, and pay well. Narbondo set in to whistle again, this time out of the innocence of good cheer. But the effect on Hargreaves was so immediately consumptive and maddening that Narbondo gave it off abruptly. There's no use baiting the man into ruination before the job is done. Wiping the lanky hair from his eyes and reaching for his coat, Dr. Narbondo rose and stepped silently from the room, carrying his teacup with him. On the morning street outside, he smiled maliciously at an orange sun that burned through evaporating fog, then through the dregs of his tea, cup and all, over the vine-draped stone wall, and strode away east up Archcliff Road, composing in his mind a letter to the Royal Academy. "Damn me," mumbled Bill Kraken through the fingers mashed against his mouth. He wiped furiously at the tea leaves and tea that ran down his neck and collar. The cup that hit him on the ear had fallen and broken on the stones of the garden. He peered up over the wall at the retreating figure of the hunchback and added this last unintentional insult to the list of villainies he'd suffered over the years. He'd have his turn yet. Why St. Ives hadn't given him leave to merely beat the capers out of this devil Hargreaves, he couldn't at all fathom. The man was a monster. There was no gainsaying it. They could set off one of his own devices, hoist him on his own filthy petard, so to speak. His remains would be found amid the wreckage of infernal machines built with his own hands. The world would have owed Bill Kraken a debt. But Narbondo, St. Ives had insisted, would have found another willing accomplice. Hargreaves was only a pawn, and pawns could be dealt with easily enough when the time came. St. Ives couldn't afford to tip his hand. Kraken crouched out from behind the wall and slipped away in Narbondo's wake. Keeping to the other side of the road when the hunchback entered a stationer's, then circling round to the back when Narbondo went in at the post office door. Stepping through the dark, arched rear entry, a ready lie on his lips in case he was confronted, Kraken found himself in a tiny, deserted room. He slid behind a convenient heap of crates, peeping through slats at an enormously fat, stoop man who lumbered in, tossed Narbondo's letter into a wooden bin, and lumbered back out. Kraken snatched up the letter, tucked it into his coat, and in a moment was back in the sunlight, prying at the stickum with his index finger. 10 minutes later, he was in at the front door of the post office, grinning into the wide face of the postman and mailing Narbondo's missive for the second time that morning. "Surely it's a bluff," said Jack Owlsby, scowling at Langdon St. Ives. The four of them sat on lawn chairs in the gardens, listening with half an ear to the lackluster tootings of a tired orchestra. What would it profit him to alert the Times? There'd be mayhem. If it's extortion he's after, this won't further his hopes by an inch. The threat of it might, replied St. Ives. If his promise to pitch the earth into the path of a comet weren't taken seriously, the mere suggestion that the public be apprised of the magnetic affinity of the comet and the earth might be. It's pale in comparison, I grant you that, but the panic that would ensue if an ably stated message were to reach the right journalist. St. Ives paused and shook his head as if such panic wasn't to be contemplated. What was the name of that scoundrel who leaked the news of the alien threat 4 years ago? Beezer, sir, said Hasbro. He's still in the employ of the Times, and we must suppose no less likely to be in communication with the doctor today than he was then. He'd be your man, sir, if you wanted to wave the bloody shirt. I rather believe, said St. Ives, grimacing at the raucous climax of an unidentifiable bit of orchestration, that we should pay this man Beezer a visit. We can't do a thing sitting around Dover. Norbando has agreed to wait 4 days for a reply from the Academy. There's no reason to believe he won't keep his word. He's got nothing to gain by haste. The comet, after all, is 10 days off. We've got to suppose that he means just what he claims. Evil begets idiocy, gentlemen, and there is no earthly way to tell how far down the path into generation our doctor has trod. The next train to London, Hasbro. 2:45, sir. We'll be aboard her.